From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted. The Thing in the Pond by Paul Ernst. It was late afternoon when Gordon Sharp, tall, lean, and bearded, got out of the hired car at the door of Professor Wheelbold's country house. He lifted out his grips and his gun case. "That must be a right sizable shooting iron, mister," the driver drawled. "It stopped quite a few elephants in its time," replied Sharp, with his steel-blue eyes twinkling. The driver glanced oddly at him. "Well, there ain't any elephants around here, but this is a funny part of Florida, mister, just the same." Sharp's thick black beard stirred with a grin. "I read about it in the papers last night," he said. "Got a monster or something down this way, haven't you?" "That's what they say. Me? I don't take no stock in it." The hired car rattled off. The door opened, and Wheelbold's servant came out of the house. Sharp stared at him. He was small, quiet, efficient, quite different from the old Sam Clegg, the sulky, not-too-clean loafer Wheelbold had had working for him when Sharp last visited here. The man reached for the grips in the gun case. "I'll carry that," said Sharp. "Where's the professor?" "He's out by the pond," replied the servant. "I'll show you to your room and then tell him you're here." Sharp went upstairs to the man. When he was alone, he stepped to the window. His room was at the rear of the combined house and laboratory. 20 acres of weeds and neglect stretched before his eyes from the house to a small marshy puddle called Greer's Pond. Sharp remembered this as a stagnant pool fed by seepage, heated to blood warmth by the Florida sun. It was rather deep, and it teemed with small life. He could see the sluggish glint of the water now, and at one end the stoop-shouldered, shambling figure of Professor Wheelbold. Then he saw the servant start across the fields and noticed his grim, precise walk. The man contrasted humorously with the surly ruffian Sam Clegg, who had worked here 10 years ago. Sharp went downstairs to the laboratory. Wheelbold spent most of his waking hours here. He would expect to meet his ex-pupil there. The tan, powerful African explorer blinked as he entered the cool dimness of the laboratory. Then he saw that all was unchanged. There was a delicate device for registering the minute quantities of electricity generated by a growing plant. There was a little glass case in which Wheelbold had kept a bit of muscle from the heart of a chicken, a lump no larger than the head of a match, living and growing in a salt solution for 16 years. Here was the complicated apparatus with which Wheelbold increased the chlorophyll content in plants with ultraviolet rays. Then came cases of zoological monstrosities. Newts with 3 eyes, salamanders with tails where their legs should be, and heads grafted on where their tails should be. The door of the laboratory opened. "Gordon," exclaimed Professor Wheelbold, coming in, "it's good to see you again. You're looking fine." "Nothing seems changed," said Sharp heartily. "I might have stepped out yesterday instead of 10 years ago. The only new thing is your servant. You fired Sam Clegg at last, huh?" "Yes," said the professor, a muscle twitching his cheek. "A few weeks after you left. I wrote you about it, I think." "You did. And you wrote me, too, that the sullen fellow took a mean revenge by dumping several casks of chemicals and some of your most valuable laboratory equipment into Greer's Pond." The professor looked so distressed as Sharp put his big arm affectionately over the thin shoulders. "It's ancient history now," he said. "Then, why on earth did you ask me to bring an elephant gun when I came for the visit? Are you going into ballistics now?" Wheelbold did not smile back. "Not exactly," he murmured, avoiding Sharp's gaze. "Then," Sharp returned laughing, "it must be you wanted me to use it on the monster in your pool." Professor Wheelbold did not smile at this either. "So you've heard," he said. "I've heard of little else in the last 24 hours. Sharp responded, gazing at the professor with worried eyes. The Associated Press got the story. The whole country is laughing at the hoax. You'll probably have pilgrims to Greer's Pond by the thousands in a few days. What did the paper say about the hoax? Sharp lighted his pipe, his eyes continuing to probe Weebolt's. The New York papers say there is a dinosaur alive down here. The Chicago sheets think it's a sea serpent. But of course, nobody really believes there's anything cooped up in your spoonful of water. It's just another tall tale, like that of the monster in the Scottish Loch sometime. Again, the muscle twitched in Weebolt's cheek. Sharp's fingers tightened on the bowl of his pipe. The old man looked as if he actually put credence in the silly story of a monster in Greer's Pond. He must have broken recently in mind as well as in health, not to laugh with a scientist's skepticism at such talk. A monster in Greer's Pond? Of course, there may actually be some big beast like an alligator in the pond, said Sharp, keeping his tone light. It'll be sport to find out. We'll go hunting tomorrow. We'll take your spaniel, Spot. Spot's dead, Weebolt interrupted heavily. Sharp whistled. Too bad. Run over by an automobile? No, said Weebolt. Drowned. In Greer's Pond, it was 3 nights ago. I heard him barking as if his throat would split out by the pond. Then suddenly, the barking ceased. The professor stared abstractly at a glass case in which a curious monstrosity, a newt with two heads, from an egg cell, half-divided in embryo, was preserved. I went back to sleep, thinking little of it, but the next morning Spot didn't appear, so I wandered over to the pond. I saw his tracks in the soft mud next to the water's edge. They went into the water and disappeared. That sounds like a gator, all right, Sharp nodded. They go for dogs. An alligator? Mused Weebolt. Possibly. But Rayburn, who owns the land behind mine, doesn't think so. He thinks that if a big alligator was in the pool, it would be seen often on the surface of the water or on the bank. And Rayburn has never actually seen anything, nor have I. Why not drain the pond? Asked Sharp. Weebolt sighed. I am a poor man. Due to the lie of the land, draining would cost more than my entire fortune. He cleared his throat. Come on out and look around now, will you? I saw something rather interesting this noon. I was out looking at it again when you arrived. Certainly, said Sharp. Shall I take my gun? He had tried to make his voice careless, but some tone in it must have sounded wrong. You think I'm a little mad, don't you? Said Weebolt. Well, no matter. Come along. They went out by the laboratory door and started across the neglected acreage behind the house to Greer's Pond. Far off was a country road. They saw several cars slow down as they passed. Sightseers will be swarming here pretty soon to look at the monster in the pond, predicted Sharp. Weebolt shivered as if he were cold. I know. Dozens of people crowding around the edge of the pool. Something must be done at once. They reached the scum-flecked pond. Sharp remembered it well. He and Weebolt had signed out many a wiggling subject for laboratory experimentation. Oddly, he saw no small life now. Here, said Weebolt in a low, strained tone, this is what I wanted to show you. Sharp gazed where the old professor pointed. He saw cow tracks, ordinary cow tracks etched in the mud by the water. A fresh wave of pity for Weebolt grew in his breast. Then he moistened his lips as he peered closer at the tracks, and he forgot to pity Weebolt so tolerantly. The cow tracks led from the property on Rayburn's side of the pond to the edge of the pool. Indistinct till they reached the mud, they were only too clear there. The tracks were deep. They were slurred and close-bunched. The animal that had made them had been pulling back frantically, straining back with deep-planted hoofs from the water and being inexorably hauled into it just the same. It must have been a monster gator, muttered Sharp stubbornly. It must have been. But there were no gator tracks anywhere to be seen. Instead, half effacing the cow tracks in some places, there was something the like of which he had never observed in all his big game hunting days. The mud around some of the cow tracks had been pressed flat and smooth as if a heavy, fat body had slithered across there. Here comes my neighbor, he heard Weebolt say. He looked up and saw man approaching them. He was a big, burly fellow in faded blue overalls. He was striding toward them aggressively, swiftly, glaring at the professor as he came. "I might have known I should look here first for my cow," he shouted when he was still 50 yards from them. "Spent the whole day phoning around to see if she'd gone into someone else's barn. But I should have known where she'd disappeared to." He reached them with the last words and took just one look at the tracks. His black eyes glittered with rage. "Professor," he grated, "what the hell's in this pond? What in tarnation," he glared at the tracks, "can drag a full-grown gersney down into the water?" "Who knows, Rayburn?" said Weeble, his old voice trembling. "I lost my dog, you know, a few nights ago." "It's probably a gator," Sharp offered. Rayburn whirled on him. "A gator? Whoever you are and wherever you come from, I reckon you must know better than that. You don't see any tracks, do you? And nobody's ever seen one sunning itself, have they? And what would one gator do with a whole cow?" He whirled back to Weibold, and his voice tensed Sharp's muscles angrily. "Professor, we've been mighty tolerant around here about the devil's work you do alone in that laboratory of yours, and we ain't said nothing, and we ain't done nothing, though we all know your work was against nature. Now I reckon it's time to think of acting. You know, there has been folks lynched around this part of the country." Sharp's fist clenched, but he remembered that this man had just lost a valuable animal. "Why do you talk like that to me?" faltered the old professor. "Whatever is in this pond—" "Professor," Rayburn interrupted, "you know what's in that pond." "I don't, and no one else does. But you do. I can see it in your face. I've been seeing it there for a month." "I assure you," mumbled Weebold. But Rayburn didn't stop to hear. He turned on his heel and walked away. Sharp gazed at Weebold. "You see," murmured the professor wearily, "I have something actual to fear, regardless of what may or may not be in that slimy water." Sharp's gaze held steady. "What is in there, professor?" I haven't the faintest idea. As a scientist, I simply cannot admit that." "What?" Sharp rapped out as the old man stopped. "Nothing," Webb sighed, and he would say no more. Sharp turned from him to stare at the pond again. Covered in spots with green scum, clear in spots like a black mirror, the surface of the opaque water lay without a ripple to feather it. The eye could not penetrate more than a foot or so down into the motionless, silt-filled pool. Sharp stared harder. No movement? No ripples? But there were. In the center of the pond, a faint stir of water grew regularly into being, so faint that Sharp had not caught it till now. It ringed out, wider and wider, barely stirring the scum, till it reached the shores. In slow rhythmic succession, the ripples ringed from the center of the pond to stir at last along the shore, as if something down under there was breathing with a slow heave of sides or gills, or as if a mighty heart was beating down there, with each slow pulsation registering on the recording surface of the pool. That was more apt. The water was stirring regularly like a huge, slow pulse. Sharp's fingernails pressed into the palms of his hand, but his voice was even as he said, "Got any meat in your refrigerator?" Weebold glanced at him quickly. It was impossible to guess whether his old eyes had been alert enough to catch the steady stir of the water. "I have a slab of bacon and some beef," he said. "Good," Sharp's voice was incisive. "We won't wait till tomorrow to hunt. Visitors might be crowding in by then, and that might be unhealthy. Would you mind stepping to the house and asking your man to bring my gun and the meat here to me?" Weeble nodded and turned away. Sharp watched them shamble across the field and turned back to watch the enigmatic surface of the pond. Down in its mysterious black depths, Weeble brought the meat and gun back himself. Sharp frowned at him. "No need for you to stay around, sir. Nothing may rise to this bait at all, since the cow was dragged in so recently." "I will stay," said the old professor. "There might be danger." "I will stay, Gordon." Sharp shrugged and loaded the big gun. They went to the edge of the pond, not speaking to each other, not looking at each other. Sharp threw the slab of bacon as near to the center of the pool as he could. It splashed in the green scum. There was no answering splash. Ripples welled out from the disturbance and gradually subsided. That was all. It might be that the thing has such a low nervous organization that it can't tell when food or prey is near, faltered Weebold. His face was white and his hands were shaking. We might ask the cow what her opinion is, said Sharp. He picked up the chunk of beef and sent it after the bacon. It hit the scum even nearer the center of the pool. The slimy surface of the pond boiled a little near to the meat. It seemed to hump up slightly. Grimly, silently, the commotion in the water grew. With strained intensity, the two men stared. Something broke the surface of the pond. Something that was pallidly pink and smooth and glistening. Something that was hollowed in the center, like a gigantic cup. The monstrous cup closed around the meat, just as Sharp's gun roared out. Both men saw a hole torn in the pink fringe of the cup. Both men saw the fringe continue to clamp down over the meat, as if nothing had happened. Then the thing sank silently under the water. There was a soft sucking noise as an eddy whirled above. The eddy died down, and there was nothing. Sharp wiped the palms of his hand on his trouser leg. It didn't even feel it, he breathed, his eyes wide and staring. A slug that would have stopped an elephant? And it didn't even feel it. Weebold's trembling fingers were plucking at his lips. Like firing into a sofa cushion, Sharp went on. No chance for the explosive bullet to get in its work. It simply tore through. He stopped abruptly. Weebold's hand clutched convulsively at his arm. The two glared at the water before them. A commotion was growing there. Once again, the green scum was humping upward as something sluggishly sought the surface, and the commotion rippled the stagnant warm water in a straight line for the spot where Sharp and Weebold stood. With a hoarse exclamation, Sharp jerked the arm from the professor's clutch and ripped the bolt of his gun out and back. He leveled it towards the seething water. The surface of the water broke at last, almost at their feet. Something pallidly pink shone wet and sleek above the green scum. It was coming steadily through the water toward them. It reached the shore. Rather, the front of it reached the shore. The rear of it trailed back out of sight in the black water. It began with a queer hitching movement to climb out onto the mud. Something roughly oblong and flat, like an undulating pink blanket, something that was simply a blind, sluggish lump, without limbs or tentacles, exuding mucus to protect its tender-looking surface from twigs and pebbles in the mud. As the thing crawled further and further up on the bank, it seemed to slough off chunks of itself. But in an instant it was apparent that the chunks were half-dissolved bits of meat. A horn dropped, and some whitened bones, and the skull of a cow. "Shoot!" cried the professor. Sharp only stood there, peering over his sights at the thing. It hitched toward them, progressing by humping itself up in folds and then straightening out, expanding and contracting in rhythmic waves of movement, and still its bulk trailed endlessly from the pond. "Shoot!" screeched Weebold. Sharp pressed the trigger. Again the heavy caliber gun roared out in the silent afternoon. Again a big bullet tore into the viscous, tender-looking pink mass, and again it sliced right through, with not enough resistance offered for the explosion of the bullet. A jagged hole, oozing straw-colored fluid, yawned in the loathsome pinkish mass. The bulk of it stirred as the bullet exploded in the mud beneath, but it kept on coming. Both men ran, sweat streaming down their faces, ran as if pursued by fiends. 100 yards away, they stopped and looked back. There was a subsiding commotion at the water's edge. Something flipped sluggishly up from the green scum and then sank. "Maybe it's dead?" quavered Professor Weebold. Sharp drew a long breath and then began to stride purposely toward the house. "You know better than that," he said quietly. "That thing could never die. It could be blown to bits and still not die, because it isn't alive. Not as a complete organism. Anyhow, it has no nervous system. It has no vital organs. It simply has cellular, multifarious life. Isn't that right, Professor?" Weebold said nothing. He hurried to keep pace with Sharp's long strides. "What are you going to do, Gordon?" he asked as they neared the house.
"I'm going to do some telephoning," he said. "I'm going to order some dynamite and about a carload of sulfuric acid, and I'm going to have a contractor come out first thing in the morning. We'll dynamite the pool at dawn. Then the contractor can put up a high fence. After that, we'll sluice the pool with sulfuric acid and keep sluicing it. That's the only way I can think of to destroy utterly the thing in the pond. And if it isn't destroyed," he added grimly, "I see no reason why it shouldn't keep on growing indefinitely, till it's the size of a 10-story building. Do you?" Weebold only looked at him miserably, imploringly. Next morning, with Pearl first streaking the east, the two went back to the pond. Sharp walked carefully, carrying half a dozen sticks of dynamite tied in a bundle with a short fuse attached. The pond looked like a great green-flecked fire opal in the early morning. Sharp stared at it. Off-center a little, perhaps 30 yards from where they stood, a faint ripple formed regularly on the still surface to ring the stagnant water and subside gently on the shores. Beat, beat, beat. Sharp lighted the fuse and threw the bundle of dynamite. It fell with a splash in the center of the rhythmic ripples. Both men ran from the pool, covering their ears, holding their mouths open. There was a thunderous roar before they had taken 20 steps. They were knocked from their feet. Water and mud rained down on them. Water and mud and something else. Fragments of pallid, pinkish substance that struck down on them like clammy hands, to plop off onto the ground, and to begin at once with queer humping movements to slide back to the boiling, half-empty pond. Alive, but not alive. Frightful blind growth, as vital and indestructible as a living primal ooze. No death for it, but utter annihilation, muttered Sharp. But it will be weeks before any of the pieces can become dangerously big. Long before that, we'll have the place burned out with acid. The two got up slowly. Sharp looked at the professor for a long time. I know what you're thinking, said Weebold, but it can't be true. It can't. By all the laws of biology, it can't. Professor, said Sharp, it was about 10 years ago that your discharge servant got back at you by dumping that laboratory stuff into the pool, wasn't it? Yes, said the old man, his lips twitching. Among the stuff was a lot of sodium, potassium, and calcium salts, and probably a barrel of sugar, guessed Sharp. Yes, admitted Weebold. Now, while I was here 10 years ago, you cut off a bit of that chicken heart muscle you've kept living and pulsing for 16 years in a solution of potassium, calcium, sodium, and sugar. I remember that distinctly. You've cut off several bits, otherwise the stuff would outgrow the nourishment capacity of the case. What happened to the fragment? It got lost or something. It's conceivable that it was among the stuff your servant dumped into the pond, isn't it? Such a fantastic accident, mumbled Weebold.
All accidents are fantastic, said Sharp curtly. That's why they call them accidents. It's conceivable, isn't it? Weebold nodded. And in this warm, life-filled pond, Sharp pursued relentlessly, the tiny bit of muscle substance flourished. It absorbed the chemicals freakishly dumped in with it, and finally all the small life. Then it began to reach out for more food in its voracious growth.
I tell you, it's impossible, almost shrieked the professor. It could not live outside a laboratory. Ask any scientist.
I prefer to ask Rayburn's cow or your dog, Sharp cut in dryly. Weebold spread his hands in a defeated gesture. Gordon, he said in a different tone, I'm an old man. I have neither the money nor the energy to move to another part of the country and set up my laboratory all over again, which I'd have to do if the people around here believe that some experiment in my laboratory really was responsible for this. Now, you see how impossible it is that a tiny bit of flesh from the heart of a dead chicken could grow to a thing like that, don't you? Sharp watched the last of the small pink fragments fold over on itself on its way to the water of Greer's Pond.
The little fragments slip sluggishly under the green scum of the surface. "We'll say it's impossible," he conceded at last. "Hey, you down there," by Harold Rolseth. Calvin Spender drained his coffee cup and wiped his mouth with the back of his hand. He belched loudly and then proceeded to fill a corn cob pipe with coarsely shredded tobacco. He scratched the match across the top of the table and, holding it to his pipe, he sucked noisily until billows of acrid smoke poured from his mouth. Dora Spender sat across the table from her husband, her breakfast scarcely touched. She coughed lightly and then, as no frown appeared on Calvin's brow, she said, "Are you going to dig in the well this morning, Calvin?" Calvin fixed his small red-rimmed eyes upon her and, as if she had not spoken, said, "Get going at the chores right away. You're going to be hauling up dirt." "Yes, Calvin," Dora whispered. Calvin cleared his throat, and the action caused his Adam's apple to move convulsively under the loose red folds of skin on its neck. He rose from the table and went out the kitchen door, kicking viciously at the tawny cat which had been lying on the doorstep. Dora gazed after him and wondered for the thousandth time what it was that Calvin reminded her of. It was not some other person, it was something else. Sometimes it seemed as though the answer was about to spring to her mind, as just now when Calvin had cleared his throat. But always it stopped, just short of her consciousness. It was disturbing to know with such certainty that Calvin looked like something other than himself, and yet not know what that something was. Someday, though, Dora knew, the answer would come to her. She rose hurriedly from the table and set about her chores. Halfway between the house and the barn, a donut-shaped mound of earth surrounded a hole. Calvin went to the edge of the hole and stared down into it distastefully. Only necessity could have forced him to undertake this task, but it was either this digging or the hauling of barrels and barrels of water each day from Nord's Fisher farm a half mile down the road. Calvin's herd of scrub cattle was small, but the amount of water it consumed was astonishing. For 2 weeks now, ever since his well had gone dry, Calvin had been hauling water, and the disagreeable chore was becoming more unpleasant because of neighbor Nord's clumsy hints that some form of payment for the water would not be amiss. Several feet back from the edge of the hole, Calvin had driven a heavy iron stake into the ground, and to this was attached a crude rope ladder. The rope ladder had become necessary when the hole had reached a depth well beyond the length of any wooden ladder Calvin owned. Calvin hoped desperately that he would not have to go much deeper. He estimated that he was now down 50 or 60 feet, a common depth for many wells in the area. His greatest fear was that he would hit a stratum of rock which would call for the services of a well-drilling outfit. For such a venture, both his funds and his credit rating were far too low. Calvin picked up a bucket, to which was attached a long rope, and lowered it into the hole. It was Dora's back-breaking task to haul the bucket up hand over hand after Calvin had filled it from the bottom of the hole. With a mumbled curse, Calvin emptied his pipe and started down the rope ladder. By the time he got to the bottom of the hole and had filled the bucket, Dora should be there to haul it up. If she weren't, she would hear about it. From the house, Dora saw Calvin prepare to enter the well, and she worked with desperate haste to complete her chores. She reached the hole just as a muffled shot from below indicated that the bucket was full. Summoning all her strength, Dora hauled the bucket up. She emptied it and then lowered it into the hole again. While she waited for the second bucket load, she examined the contents of the first. She was disappointed to find it had only the normal moistness of underground earth. No water seeped from it. In her own fashion, Dora was deeply religious, and at each tenth bucket she pulled up, she murmured an urgent prayer that it would contain more water in it than earth. She had settled up praying at every tenth bucket load because she did not believe it in good taste to pester God with every bucket. Also, she varied the wording of each prayer, feeling that God must become bored with the same petition repeated over and over. On this particular morning, as she lowered the bucket for its tenth loading, she prayed, "Please, God, let something happen this time. Let something really and truly happen so I won't have to haul up any more dirt." Something happened almost immediately. As the rope slackened in her hand, indicating that the bucket had reached the bottom, a scream of sheer terror came up from the hole, and the rope ladder jerked violently. Whimpering sounds of mortal fear sounded faintly, and the ladder grew taut with heavy strain. Dora fell to her knees and peered down to the darkness. "Calvin," she called. "Are you all right? What is it?" Then, with startling suddenness, Calvin appeared, literally shooting out of the hole. At first, Dora was not sure if it was Calvin. The peeled redness of his face was gone. Now it was a yellowish green. He was trembling violently and had trouble breathing. It must be a heart attack, Dora thought, and tried mightily to suppress the surge of joy that swept over her. Calvin lay upon the ground panting. Finally, he gained control of himself. Under ordinary circumstances, Calvin did not converse with Dora, but now he seemed eager to talk. "You know what happened down there?" he said in a shaky voice. "You know what happened? The complete bottom dropped right out of that hole. All of a sudden it went, and there I was, standing on nothing but air. If I hadn't grabbed hold of that last rung of the ladder, why, that hole must be 1,000 feet the way the bottom dropped out of it." Calvin babbled on, but Dora did not listen. She was filled with awe at the remarkable way in which her prayer had been answered. If the hole had no more bottom, there would be no more dirt to haul up. When Calvin had regained his strength, he crept to the edge of the hole and peered down. "What are you going to do, Calvin?" Dora asked timidly. "Do? I'm going to find out how far down that hole goes. Get the flashlight from the kitchen." Dora hurried off. When she returned, Calvin had a large ball of binder at twine he had gotten from the tool shed. He tied the flashlight securely to the end of the line, switched it on, and lowered it into the hole. He paid out the line for about 100 feet and then stopped. The light was only a feeble glimmer down below and revealed nothing. Calvin lowered the light another 100 feet, and this time it was only a twinkling speck as it swung at the end of the line. Calvin released another long length of twine, and another, and now the light was no longer visible, and the large ball of twine had shrunk to a small tangle. "Almost a full 1,000 feet," he whispered in awe. "No bottom yet. Might as well pull it up." But the line did not come up with Calvin's pull. It stretched and grew taut, but it did not yield to his tugging. "Must be something caught on it," Calvin muttered, and gave the line a sharp jerk. In response, there was a downward jerk that almost tore the line from his hand. "Hey," yelled Calvin, "the line, it jerked." "But Calvin," Dora protested. "Don't Calvin me. I tell you, there's something on the end of this line." He gave another tug, and again the line was almost pulled from his hand. He tied the line to the stake and sat down to ponder the matter. "Don't make sense," he said, more to himself than to Dora. "What could be underground a good 1,000 feet? Tentatively, he reached over and pulled lightly on the line. This time there was no response, and rapidly he began hauling it up. When the end of the line came into view, there was no flashlight attached to it. Instead, there was a small white pouch of a leather-like substance. Calvin opened the pouch with trembling fingers and shook into his palm a bar of yellow metal and a folded piece of parchment. The bar of metal was not large, but seemed heavy for its size. Calvin got out his jackknife and scratched the point of the blade across the metal. The knife blade bit into it easily. "Gold," said Calvin, his voice shaky. "Must be a whole pound of it. And just for a measly flashlight? They must be crazy down there." He thrust the gold bar into his pocket and opened the small piece of parchment. One side was closely covered with a fine script. Calvin turned it this way and that, and then tossed it on the ground. "Foreigners," he said. "No wonder they ain't got any sense, but it's plain they need flashlights." "But, Calvin," said Dora, "how could they get down there? There ain't any mines in this part of the country." "Ain't you ever heard of them secret government projects?" asked Calvin scornfully. "This must be one of them. Now I'm going to town and get me a load of flashlights. They must need them bad. Now, mind you watch that hole good. Don't let no one go near it." Calvin strode to the battered pickup, which was standing near the barn, and a minute later was rattling down the highway toward Harmony Junction. Dora picked up a bit of parchment which Calvin had thrown away. She could make nothing of the writing on it. It was all very strange. If it were some secret government undertaking, why would foreigners be engaged in it? And why would they need flashlights so urgently as to pay a fortune for one? Suddenly it occurred to her that possibly the people down below didn't know there were English-speaking people up above. She hurried into the house and rummaged through Calvin's rickety desk for paper and pencil. In her search she found a small ragged dictionary, and she took this with her to the kitchen table. Spelling did not come easy to Dora. Her note was a series of questions. Why were they down there? Who were they? Why did they pay so much for an old flashlight? As she started for the well, it occurred to her that possibly the people down there might be hungry. She went back to the kitchen and wrapped a loaf of bread and a fair-sized piece of ham in a clean dish towel. She added a postscript to her note, apologizing for the fact that she had nothing better to offer them. Then the thought came to her that since people down there were obviously foreigners and possibly not too well versed in English, the small dictionary might be of help to them in answering her note. She wrapped the dictionary with the food in the towel. It took Dora a long while to lower the bucket, but finally the twine grew slack in her hands, and she knew the bucket had reached the bottom. She waited a few moments and then tugged the line gently. The line held firm below, and Dora seated herself on the pile of soil to wait. The warm sunlight felt good on her back, and it was pleasant to sit and do nothing. She had no fear that Calvin would return soon. She knew that nothing on earth, or under it, could keep Calvin from visiting a number of taverns once he was in town, and that with each tavern visited, time would become more and more meaningless to him. She doubted that he would return before morning. After a half hour, Dora gave the line a questioning tug, but it did not yield. She did not mind. It was seldom that she had time to idle away. Usually when Calvin went to town, he burdened her with chores to be done during his absence, coupling each order with a threat of what waited her should his instructions not be carried out. Dora waited another half hour before giving the line another tug. This time there was a sharp answering jerk, and Dora began hauling the bucket upward. It seemed much heavier now, and twice she had to pause for a rest. When the bucket reached the surface, she saw why it was heavier. "My goodness," she murmured, as she viewed the dozen or so yellow metal bars in the bucket. "They must be real hungry down there." A sheet of the strange parchment was also in the bucket, and Dora picked it out, expecting to see the strange script of the first note. "Well, I declare," she said when she saw that the note was in English. It was the same print as the dictionary, and each letter had been made with meticulous care. She read this note slowly, shaping each word with her lips as she read. "Your language is barbaric, but the crude code book you sent down made it easy for our scholars to decipher it. We too wonder about you. How have you overcome the problem of living in the deadly light? Our legends tell of a race living on the surface, but intelligent reasoning has forced us to ridicule these old tales until now. We would still doubt that you are surface dwellers, except for the fact that our instruments show without question that the opening above us leads to the deadly light. The clumsy death ray which you sent us indicates that your scientific development is very low. Other than an artifact of another race, it has no value to us. We send gold as a courtesy payment only. The food you call bread is not acceptable to our digestive systems, but the ham is beyond price. It is obviously the flesh of some creature, and we will exchange a double weight of gold for all that you can send us. Send more immediately. Also, send a concise history of your race, and arrange for your best scientists, such as they are, to communicate with us. Glar, the master." "Land's sake," said Dora. "Real bossy they are. I have a good mind not to send them anything." "I don't dare send them more ham. Calvin would notice if any more is gone." Dora took the gold bars to her petunia bed beside the house and buried them in the loose black soil. She paid no heed to the sound of a car coming down the highway at high speed until it passed the house, and wild squawking sounded above the roar of the motor. She hurried around to the front of the house. Knowing already what had happened, she stared in dismay at the four white leghorns which lay along the road. Now Calvin would charge her with negligence and beat her into unconsciousness. Fear sharpened her wits. Perhaps if she could dispose of the bodies, Calvin would think foxes had got them. Hastily, she gathered up the dead chickens and feathers which lay scattered about. When she was finished, there was no evidence of the disaster. She carried the chickens to the back of the house, wondering how she could best dispose of them. Suddenly, as she glanced toward the hole, the answer came to her. An hour later, the four chickens were dressed and neatly cut up. Ignoring the other instructions in the note, she sent the bulky parcel of chicken down into the hole. She sat down again to enjoy the luxury of doing nothing. When an hour later she picked up the line, there was an immediate response from below. The bucket was exceedingly heavy this time, and she was fearful that the line might break. She was dizzy with fatigue when she finally hauled the bucket over to the edge of the hole. This time there were several dozen bars of gold in it and a brief note in the same precise lettering as before. Our scientists are of the opinion that the flesh you sent down is that of a creature you call chicken. This is the supreme food. Never have we eaten anything so delicious. To show our appreciation, we are sending you a bonus payment. Your code book indicates that there is a larger creature similar to chicken called turkey. Send us turkey immediately. I repeat, send us turkey immediately. Glar the master. Land sakes, Gastora, they must have ate that chicken raw. Now, where in tarnation would I get a turkey? She buried the gold bars in another part of a petunia bed. Calvin returned about 10 o'clock the next morning. His eyes were bloodshot and a face that was mottled red. The loose skin on his neck hung lower than usual, and more than ever he reminded Dora of something which eluded her. Calvin stepped down from the pickup, and Dora cringed. But he seemed too tired and preoccupied to bother with her. He surveyed the hole glumly, then got back into the truck and backed it to the edge of the mound of earth. On the back of the truck was a winch with a large drum of steel cable. "Fix me something to eat," he ordered Dora. Dora hurried into the house and began preparing ham and eggs. Each moment she expected Calvin to come in and demand to know, with a few blows, what was holding up his meal. But Calvin seemed very busy in the vicinity of the hole. When Dora went out to call him to eat, she found he had done a surprising amount of work. He had attached an oil drum to the steel cable. This hung over a heavy steel rod, which rested across the hole. Stakes driven into the ground on each side of the hole held the rod in place. "Your breakfast is ready, Calvin," said Dora. "Shut up," Calvin answered. The winch was driven by an electric motor, and Calvin ran a cable from the motor to an electric outlet on the yard light post. From the cab he took a number of boxes and placed them in the oil drum. "A whole 100 of them," he chuckled, more to himself than to Dora. 59 cents apiece. Peanuts. One bar of gold will buy thousands. Calvin threw the switch which controlled the winch, and with sickening force Dora suddenly realized the terrible thing that would soon happen. The creatures down below had no use or regard for flashlights. Down went the oil drum, the cable screeching shrilly as it passed over the rod above the hole. Calvin got an oil can from the truck and applied oil generously to the rod and cable. In a very short while, the cable went slack and Calvin stopped the winch. "I'll give them an hour to load up the gold," he said, and went to the kitchen for his delayed breakfast. Dora was practically in a state of shock. What would happen when the flashlights came back up with an insulting note in the English was too horrible to contemplate. Coward would learn about the gold she had received and very likely kill her. Calvin ate his breakfast leisurely. Dora busied herself with household tasks, trying with all her might to cast out of her mind the terrible thing which was soon to happen. Finally, Calvin glanced at the wall clock, yawned widely, and tapped out his pipe. Ignoring Dora, he went out to the hole. In spite of her terrible fear, Dora could not resist following him. It was as if some power outside herself forced her to go. The winch was already reeling in the cable when she got to the hole. It seemed only seconds before the oil drum was up. The grin on Calvin's face was broad as he reached out over the hole and dragged the oil drum to the edge. A look of utter disbelief replaced the grin as he looked into the drum. His Adam's apple seemed to vibrate, and once again part of Dora's mind tried to recall what it was that Calvin reminded her of. Calvin was making flat bawling sounds like a lost calf. He hauled her drum out of the hole and dumped its contents on the ground. The flashlights, many of them dented and with lenses broken, made a sizable pile. With a tremendous kick, Calvin sent flashlights flying in all directions. One, the note attached, landed at Dora's feet. Either Calvin was so blinded by rage that he didn't see it, or he assumed it was written in the same unreadable script as the first note. "You down there!" he screamed into the hole. "You filthy swine! I'll fix you! I'll make you sorry you ever double-crossed me! I'll... He dashed for the house, and Dora hastily snatched up the note. "You are even more stupid than we thought," she read. "Your clumsy death rays are useless on us. We informed you of this. We want Turkey. Send us Turkey immediately. Glar, the master." She crumbled the note swiftly as Calvin came from the house with his double-barreled shotgun. For a moment, Dora thought that he knew everything and was about to kill her. "Please, Calvin," she said. "Shut up," Calvin said. "You saw me work the winch. Can you do it?" "Why, yes, but what..." "Listen, you stupid cow. I'm going down there and fix those dirty foreigners. You send me down and bring me up." He seized Dora by the shoulder. "And if you mess things, I'll fix you too. I'll really, truly fix you." Dora nodded dumbly. Calvin put his gun in the oil drum and pushed it to the center of the hole. Then, hanging on to the cable, he carefully lowered himself into the drum. "Give me just 1 hour to run those dirty rats down, then bring me back up," he said. Dora threw the switch, and the oil drum went down. When the cable slackened, she stopped the winch. She spent most of the hour praying that Calvin would not find the people down below and become a murderer. Exactly an hour later, Dora started the oil drum upward. The motor labored mightily, as though under a tremendous strain, and the cable seemed stretched almost to the breaking point. Dora gasped when the oil drum came into view. Calvin was not in it. She shut off the motor and hastened to the drum, half expecting to find Calvin crouching down inside. But Calvin was not there. Instead, there were scores of gold bars, and on top of them, a sheet of familiar white parchment. "Land sakes," Dora said, as she took in a full view of the drum's contents. She had no idea of the value of the treasure upon which she gazed. She only knew it must be immense. Carefully, she reached down and picked out the note, which she read in her slow, precise manner. "Not even the exquisite flavor of the chicken compares to the incomparable goodness of the live turkey you sent down to us. We must confess that our concept of turkey was quite different, but this is of no consequence. So delectable was the turkey that we are again sending you a bonus payment. We implore you to send us more turkey immediately. Glar, the master." Dora read the note a second time to make sure she understood it fully. "Well, I declare," she said in considerable wonder. "I declare."